Blog Talk Radio.
It's 3 p.m., and I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Everything is political in your life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. We will be talking to those politicians that are working for you and talking about those politicians that are working against you. Just because they're a Democrat, or just because they're a Republican, and you voted that way your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there who are working for your benefit, and we are going to bring them to you. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to ask them questions. We're going to let you ask them questions. And we're going to be discussing education system, the military, science, music, sports, oh, and health care. Do you have it? Do you need it? Are your 26-year-olds still on the family health care plan? Or, as the regressive party says, Obamacare. We will bring you what you need to know, because this is the last word. And everything from the cities, counties, state, nation, the entire world. So sit down and get a pencil, paper, and take this graduate education experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson.
Good afternoon. It's it's February 25th, 2022. This is the last word. My name is Michael Lawson. And I'm telling you, what's going to do show today, because I had so much to do. The house still hasn't been worked on yet. The guys had to postpone the time because it got rained here and they didn't finish the other job. So I didn't put in my keys to my car yet, sitting crushed in my driveway. I got the envelope. I didn't fill that out because I was so busy with other stuff. I helped my grandson with his master project he has to do about History Month. I finished working on this stuff till 4:45 this morning. But anyway, more of that later. Right now, we have to hear from another one of our great, great broadcasters, Mr. Michael Cohen.
Michael Cohen, and you're listening to the Mea Culpa podcast. In a stunning rebuke of his former boss, Mike Pence uttered the words so many of his fellow Republicans are afraid to say.
Trump is wrong.
President Trump is wrong.
Trump is wrong.
It seems that Pence finally grew some fucking balls by saying directly what he'd been gradually pointing to for more than a year. Donald Trump was wiping his ass with the Constitution in his ploy to overturn the 2020 election. No shit, you don't say.
The former vice president rebuking his former boss, the former president, Donald Trump, essentially saying the president is wrong. The presidency belongs to the American people, and the American people alone.
Speaking at a Federalist Society event in Florida, Trump's sycophantic second-in-command addressed the issue more head-on than ever before. He did so after Trump said over the weekend that Pence could have and should have tried to unilaterally overturn the election.
But there are those in our party who believe that as the presiding officer over the joint session of Congress, that I possess unilateral authority to reject Electoral College votes. And I heard this week that President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president. Under the Constitution, I had no right to change the outcome of our election.
The substance of Pence's comments were much different from what he said before. But on Friday, he tied it all together and directly invoked Trump in a way that he hadn't ever before, and in a way that's very likely to stick in Trump's craw and force a more direct clash between the two of them.
Trump is wrong.
Look, I appreciate that he did it. It is a little bit, you know, water is wet. The earth is round. It's an obvious statement. Barbara and I are both lawyers. You don't have to go to law school to know that the vice president can't overturn an election. It's really dangerous what Mr. Trump is trying to allege, and that so many Republicans are falling in line with this big lie.
Pence said on the morning of January 6, 2021, that he didn't have the right to accept or reject Electoral College votes unilaterally. He also described that idea as un-American last summer. But in neither case did he describe these as being necessarily Trump's ideas.
Well, I think what you're seeing is, you know, sort of the Trump operation is in sort of a meltdown. Of course, Mike Pence is right. Donald Trump was wrong, and he basically also called him un-American. And he did it in front of the conservative Federalist Society members who gave him a standing ovation. And at this same convention, Ron DeSantis was also being interviewed and speaking with Kayleigh McEnany, who has turned over, apparently, reportedly, a lot of her documents and everything to the committee. You have Mike Pence staff meeting with the committee, talking to them, turning over documents. Now all the archived documents are being turned over. The walls are closing in.
Trump had invoked the idea of Pence unilaterally overturning the election in the run-up to January 6th. But he generally focused merely on the idea that Pence would send the issues back to the states to consider what to do about the bogus claims of voter fraud. Others around Trump have also, in the years since January 6th, distanced themselves from the more drastic idea of having Pence try to declare Trump the winner.
I wish we had seen a stronger pronouncement from the former vice president, though. He seems to have one foot in. He might just as well jump in off the deep end and go ahead and voluntarily testify and tell the truth. That's something that he hasn't at least publicly acknowledged that he's willing to do up until now. And where we are with both the investigation that's going on Capitol Hill and perhaps with a criminal investigation in the Justice Department is we seem to be right at the precipice of what the former president actually said, acknowledged, and did in the run-up to January 6th. So having conversation precisely from someone like Mike Pence could be very important here.
Similarly, Pence said last year that he and Trump would never see eye to eye about what happened on January 6th. Now, one could infer that he was saying Trump was indeed wrong, but Pence talked about it more as if it was an honest disagreement. This is how Republicans dance around their differences when it comes to Donald Trump. They talk about Trump's ideas as if they're proposals floating in the ether that some random blogger had raised, rather than the former president of the United States effectively trying to set democracy ablaze. But Pence went further still Friday, saying not only that what Trump did was wrong and that his idea was un-American, but that it was corrosive to democracy and that it's something Republicans should abhor.
Pence is like a lot of Republicans who know better, like, I mean, a lot of Republicans who know better, but refuse to disavow Trump because it used to be they were afraid of his Twitter. Now there is no Twitter. Now they just are afraid of primary challenges. I mean, at every point, Republicans have had a chance to take the, you know, to say Trumpism, to disavow Trumpism and go for democracy and say democracy must be protected. This person is anti-democratic. And at every point, they have either said nothing or, you know, tacitly kind of encouraged him. And so we get to a point now where so much of the Republican Party is doubled down on this anti-democratic, anti, you know, voter, you know, pro-voter suppression, anti, you know, count the votes kind of thing, that we're in an impossible situation. You can't have one party that doesn't believe in the central tenet of American democracy.
This is all just window dressing, though. The big takeaway here, the oh my fucking God moment, is the fact that Pence said that Trump was wrong.
Can't understate the significance of this moment because it truly could be a flashpoint that creates a schism within the Republican Party that needs to be exploited by the rational side. Keep in mind, over the course of the past year, a lot of the GOP electorate, frankly, has been radicalized by Donald Trump into believing this notion that the 2020 election was stolen from them and that Mike Pence had the ability to unilaterally overturn it. Pence pushing back creates an off-ramp for those people to go from the radical side, hopefully to the rational side.
It's doubtful, though, that Pence's broadside will fuel more GOP potshots. He is uniquely vilified by Trump's MAGA base for his refusal to go along with Trump's attempt to overturn the election.
Pence, you're gonna carry this thing eventually to your grave, okay? Because it is a mark of shame, and you are a stone-cold coward. A stone-cold coward.
And the GOP took things one step further on Friday, hours before Pence was set to speak in Florida. The Republican National Committee approved a resolution formally censoring GOP representatives Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois for serving on a special congressional committee investigating the events of January 6th. That resolution referred to what happened that day as legitimate political discourse.
To formally censure Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and to no longer support them as members of the Republican Party.
That's right. Let me back up and say that again. The Republican fucking Party on Friday officially declared the January 6th on the Capitol and events that led to it legitimate political discourse.
The resolution from the RNC on Kinzinger and Cheney is an extraordinary document from start to finish, Nicole. At the very beginning, it starts with a preamble that says, whereas the primary mission of the Republican Party is to elect Republicans who support the United States Constitution. So that's their starting point. And then they end by saying it is Kinzinger and Cheney who should be censured because their behavior, which has been destructive to the institution of the U.S. House of Representatives, the Republican Party, and our republic. So their behavior by helping to take the lead to investigate an attack on the United States Congress makes them destructive to the institution of the U.S. House of Representatives. And it's an extraordinary document.
The Republican National Committee's vote to censor Representatives Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois at its winter meeting in Salt Lake City represents its final surrender to Trump's big lie more than a year after the party leaders initially condemned the Capitol attack, as well as Trump's conduct, only to now fucking crawl back to the former president and beg for fucking forgiveness by continually downplaying and denying what happened.
This is a moment of, another moment, I should say, of revelation of the Republican Party as an institution through its elected leaders revealing what it's become. And what it has become is an autocratic vehicle to advance an autocratic agenda that is controlled by Donald Trump in this country. And there's a couple of remarkable aspects to it. First off, is it fair to call this Stalin-esque in its rhetoric? Certainly it is. Is it gaslighting on an epic scale? Surely it is.
This is a huge what-the-fuck moment in American politics, with the GOP completely surrendering its moral duty to stay in the good graces of its authoritarian overlord.
RNC accused them of, quote, participating in a Democrat-led persecution of ordinary citizens engaged in legitimate political discourse.
In approving the censor and opting to destroy two of its own, Republicans are now fully pushing a position that they once only hinted at, that the insurrection and the actions that preceded it were acceptable.
What we already know does constitute the gravest violation of his oath of office by any president in the history of the country. A former president who provoked a violent attack on this Capitol in an effort to steal the election has resumed his aggressive effort to convince Americans that the election was stolen from him. This is a man who has demonstrated that he is at war with the rule of law. He's demonstrated that he's willing to blow through every guardrail of democracy. Any man who would watch television as police officers were being beaten, as his supporters were invading the capital of the United States, is clearly unfit for future office. Clearly can never be anywhere near the Oval Office.
The GOP censor comes at a critical juncture for the January 6th committee as it continues to unearth damning evidence of a vast criminal conspiracy presided over by the former president to overturn the election and incite violence in a desperate attempt to stay in power. By doing this now, the GOP is pivoting to a stance that doesn't even try to deny what happened, but instead leans into the facts by saying that what happened was justified.
Legitimate political discourse, breaking and entering, killing people, threatening to hang people, bringing zip ties to take people hostage, ransacking lawmakers' offices, stealing things and taking a shit and smearing it on the walls, that's legitimate political discourse to the GOP? They have lost their collective minds. Between this and book burning and cameras in people's classrooms and enemies lists and voter suppression and calling to jail their political opponents, let's be very clear. The Republican Party have abandoned democracy and abdicated their responsibility to the American experiment. Lest we forget, on the day of this event, most of these same people made speeches that absolutely denigrated what had happened because it was disgusting, lawless behavior, and they knew it. And then they changed their tune to try to blame it on outside groups like Antifa and BLM. Then they created a conspiracy theory blaming the FBI and the deep state, but voted against looking into it. And when we tried to have a bipartisan commission, they voted against it. And when we tried to set up a bipartisan committee, they refused to have any of their members sit on it. And now that we are discovering just piles of evidence that people at the highest level of command in the Republican Party and the White House were involved in an active coup, and this horrific attack was part of the plan, they're now officially claiming the entire thing was legitimate political discourse?
It also signifies the far right's complete and total ownership of the party. This is something that should terrify all Americans, especially in light of Trump's frightening statements in Texas, calling on his MAGA shock troops to storm major cities where he's under investigation.
What's the further journey from the end of the Obama administration until that moment where you start talking about locking up political opponents, or from locking up political opponents to an executioner's wall? What's the further journey? And so when we look at all of this in its totality, it's staring at it, staring us in the face. We have an autocratic movement that is headed by a former president of the United States that has completely consumed one of the two political parties, that has abandoned any pretext of fidelity to the American experiment that both political parties are supposed to be in the business of perpetuating, in the work of making the union stronger, fairer, better for our progeny. So truly an appalling moment in American life and the life of the modern Republican Party.
The GOP is locking arms with the most extreme elements in our society and opening the door for more violence and bloodshed. What happens next doesn't take a genius to predict.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. We're back. I tell you, Michael Cohen, he does has a great, great show. And if you're not listening to it, I'm catching up now. See, I'm not up to where we're at now this week. But I'm going to tell you a little bit of it. You got to tune in on, hey, I listen to him on Stitcher. But, hey, mea culpa, Michael Cohen, you got to listen to the show. It's fabulous. Anyway, he also gives a little dig at the end of the show, which I didn't play for you all, but I want to know what is going to happen if this clown, Drumpy, doesn't get punished. He needs to get punished. He needs to get punished like this damn Putin. Because that's his friend. And let me tell you something. For you people out there who have only half a brain, let me give you a little bit, because I know you haven't, this is only half a day, so you only got half of it full, only got a quarter of it full, because it takes you a whole day to get half a brain's worth. Anyway, I'm going to fill up your brain now. See, when this clown was in office, he made friends with that demonic masochist Putin, who's really off the trail now. Now, hey, I am getting rid. I want you. This is what I want. This is what I'm going to do for you, Mr. Putin, because he calls him Mr. Putin. I am going to get U.S. out of NATO. We're going to tear that thing apart, and they're no good without us. But I'm going to object to everything, and we're going to eventually say, "Hey, we're gone." It might take a second term, but we will be out of this. Next thing, we're going to drop the daggone Iran nuclear test ban treaty. We'll get rid of that. I know it's your friends. And when the disruption there is all chaotic in NATO, and the disruption in Iran is chaotic, I will make such a chaotic mess in the United States, you'll be able to run amok. And you'll get all those little bitty countries back together again for the Soviet Union. Because there'll be no one strong enough to handle you. That was the deal they made. So, the deal went on. But the only thing was, the clown didn't get elected. See, they thought this was a sure deal. That's why all these people had this stuff all written down. You would never have seen any of this stuff that was written down. You never saw all that stuff. Hey, they had an 18-minute gap in Nixon. But Nixon was a choir boy compared to these people. Choir boy. And now, Biden went in and got the NATO back together, stronger than it ever was. And he told Zelensky of Ukrainian that you better get on board with us. But it was almost too late for him to get in NATO, and they don't have the information or the. Or the ability at this time to get in NATO. So they couldn't get in NATO. But we promised him that we would do something to protect him against being bullied. That was part of him giving up the nuclear, all the nuclear weapons he had that Russia had put in there. He said, "I'm giving this up. What are you going to do? We will protect you." Well, we didn't do that. We let it slip. Because how the hell can we protect him if he's not part of NATO? How can we just go and know? Because then you start a war with the other country that's trying to bully him. And the United States can't be bullied with Russia bullying us. We're bullying them. It's nuclear war. It's a third world war. So the whole policy of why we told Zelensky to give up his nuclear weapons was a false idea. It had no guff to it because we did not plan that correctly. Well, a lot of things that didn't plan correctly. You know, it wasn't planned that Yeltsin would have okayed it, but he did, to give up the Soviet Union, just go back to Mother Russia. They really did not think about that. And what happened was that when this clown started messing around with the Ukraine, there is nothing really we could do. But see, no one ever thought that this man, who was a comedian on television in nightclubs, would get elected president of his country. And now he's showing more balls than anybody who's ever been there. Because the other guy hightailed it back to Russia. And see, the military didn't throw that other man out, who was president of Ukraine. The people threw him out. They chased his ass out and ran back to Russia. And this is what the Soviet Union is going to do. They're going to come in because they didn't think they thought it would take them 2 or 3 days. It might take them 2 or 3 months or 2 or 3 years because the people in Ukraine are going to fight. Then they don't want any of that garbage that he presented. And they see it right now. They do not have enough troops, 170,000, 190,000. They need three times that much. That's a country, 40 million people. You can't control 40 million people with 190,000. You got to remember, 190,000 is only probably 70,000 that are troops. Because every rifleman needs about 4 people that's taking care of him, besides the medics, the ammunition guy, the clothing guy. That's all part of a unit. So if you cut it down, they probably only got 70,000 people. 70,000 people cannot control 40 million. Even if they have guns and you don't. So they need 4 times that many people there. They'd probably need their whole army there. So we're looking at some major problems. And I don't know if anybody caught the match between the Iranian ambassador at the UN and the Russian ambassador at the UN. Well, the Russian ambassador at the UN is the head of the General Council. This term, or I believe it is, he's the head man. So, ambassador of Iran said, "You need to step aside because you just invaded. You broke Article 5 of the UN Charter by going in and invading another country." Another country that did not do anything to you. We have a little bit of that right here.
Well, distinguished members of the Security Council, Secretary General, Undersecretary. Before I try to deliver parts of the statement that I came here with tonight, most of it is already useless since 10 p.m. New York time. I would like to cite Article 4 of the UN Charter, and it says, "Membership in the United Nations is open to all other peace-loving states which accept the obligations contained in the present charter and in the judgment of the Organization are able and willing to carry out these obligations. Russia is not able to carry out any of the obligations. The ambassador of the Russian Federation 3 minutes ago confirmed that his president declared a war on my country. So before I read part of my statement, I would like to avail of the presence of the Secretary General and request the Secretary General to distribute among the members of the Security Council and the members of the General Assembly the legal memos by the Legal Council of the United Nations dated December 1991, and in particular the legal memo dated 19th of December 1991, the one that we've been trying to get out of the Secretariat for a very long time and we were denied to get it. The Article 4, Paragraph 2 of the Charter reads, the admission of any such state to membership in the United Nations will be affected by a decision of the General Assembly upon the recommendation of the Security Council. Mr. Secretary General, please instruct the Secretariat to distribute among the members of the Security Council and the members of the General Assembly a decision by the Security Council dated December 1991 that recommends that the Russian Federation can be a member of this organization, as well as a decision by the General Assembly dated December 1991, where the General Assembly welcomes the Russian Federation to this organization. It would be a miracle if the Secretariat is able to produce such decisions. There is nothing in the Charter of the United Nations about continuity as a sneaky way to get into the organization. So when I was coming here an hour ago or so, I was intending to ask the Russian ambassador to confirm on the record that the Russian troops will not start firing at Ukrainians today and go ahead with the offensive. It became useless 48 minutes ago. Because about 48 minutes ago, your president declared the war on Ukraine. So now I would like to ask the ambassador of the Russian Federation to say on the record that at this very moment, your troops do not shell and bomb Ukrainian cities. That your troops do not move in the territory of Ukraine. You have a smartphone, you can call Lavrov right now. We can make a pause to let you go out and call him. If you are not in a position to give an affirmative answer, the Russian Federation ought to relinquish responsibilities of the President of the Security Council, pass these responsibilities on to a legitimate member of the Security Council, a member that is respectful of the Charter, and I ask the members of the Security Council to convene an emergency meeting immediately and consider all necessary draft decisions to stop the war. Because it is too late, my dear colleagues, to speak about de-escalation. Too late. The Russian president declared the war on the record. Should I play the video of your president? Ambassador, shall I do that right now? Or you can confirm it? Do not interrupt me, please. Thank you. Then don't ask me questions when you are speaking. Proceed with your statement. Anyway, you declared the war. It is the responsibility of this body to stop the war. So I call on every one of you to do everything possible to stop the war. Or should I play the video with your president declaring the war? Thank you very much.
Again, I must say that I thank the representative of Ukraine for his statement and the questions. I wasn't planning to answer them because I've already said all I know at this point. Waking up Minister Lavrov at this time is not something I plan to do. He said the information that we have will be something we provide. And this isn't called a war, this is called a special military operation.
We just heard a dramatic speech there by Ukraine's ambassador to the United Nations.
Oh, it's not a war, it's a special military operation. Oh, a special military operation. So SMO, that's what it is. It's a SMO. Ah. Well, that's what the ambassador of Russia was saying. And I believe, I heard today, and I'm starting to believe it, and I think maybe should. What they need to do is send everybody who's in the embassy, aside, besides the maintenance crew, of the Russian embassy in Washington and every embassy in the United States. Or they close off their markets for a few days. That's what they'll do. That's what they need to do. When they take their money away, they will start complaining. See, Putin's got more. He's estimated to have over $629 billion that he's stolen out of the Republican Federation since he's been there. $629 billion, richest man in the world. But his is cash. It ain't in Bitcoin. It ain't in somebody else. He probably got it in some couple people's names that he trusts because he knows they'll. He'll kill them if they don't. It's just like the, who's that guy, the clown from James Bond, Spectre. Yeah, the organization Spectre. Special. Executive, I have to look it down. I got it right how it's done. SPECTER, I believe. Spectre. But anyway, he's got money. It takes him for years to get all his money. But see, he don't want to go out like that. He wants to go out as, he don't want to go out, period. And I hear tell that he's absolutely losing it. That his mind is not really what it used to be. I mean, I understand. I didn't hear it. I wish I did hear it. His speech the other day before the 2 minutes before the invasion started was completely rambling. It was like a Trump speech. Can you imagine? It was like a Trump speech. So the people who were listening said, you know, the man is completely off. He's off hinged. He's hinged. That's what he is. He's hinged. So we don't know exactly how he was, what he was saying, or when he was saying what he was saying. They don't know. They don't know what he was saying. And that's a major problem. That's a major problem if you don't know what the man was saying. And we'll just have to see. Now, I have a bit here that I would like to play also. This was the Soviet, not Soviet, but the Secretary General of the United Nations. The Secretary General of the United Nations is a smart-ass man. Jens Stoltenberg is his name. And he got right to the point about Russia. Got right to the point. Just listen to this.
General Jens Stoltenberg has condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, saying it constituted war in Europe of a scale and of a type that we thought belonged to history. In addition, he has announced a virtual summit of NATO leaders and said more troops were being moved into Eastern European member states to deter Russian aggression beyond Ukraine. The Secretary General spoke from the NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium.
Good afternoon. Russia has attacked Ukraine. This is a brutal act of war. Our thoughts are with the brave people of Ukraine. Sadly, what we have warned against for months has come to pass. Despite all calls on Russia to change course and tireless efforts to seek a diplomatic solution, peace on our continent has been shattered. We now have war in Europe on a scale and of a type we thought belonged to history. We have just finished a meeting of the North Atlantic Council to discuss the situation. The Council also addressed the request by Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, and Slovakia to hold urgent consultations under Article 4 of the Washington Treaty. This is a grave moment for the security of Europe. Russia's unjustified and unprovoked attack on Ukraine is putting countless innocent lives at risk. With air and missile attacks, ground forces and special forces from multiple directions, targeting military infrastructure and major urban centers. This is a deliberate, cold-blooded, and long-planned invasion. Despite its litany of lies, denials, and disinformation, the Kremlin's intentions are clear for the world to see. Russia's leaders bear full responsibility for their reckless actions and the lives lost. NATO allies condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine in the strongest possible terms. It is a blatant violation of international law, an act of aggression against a sovereign, independent, and peaceful country, and a serious threat to Euro-Atlantic security. We call on Russia to immediately cease its military action, withdraw its forces from Ukraine, and choose diplomacy. We fully support Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and Ukraine's right to self-defense. Russia is using force to try to rewrite history and deny Ukraine its free and independent path. NATO's core task is to protect and defend all allies. There must be no room for miscalculation or misunderstanding. An attack on one will be regarded as an attack on all. This is our collective security guarantee. Today, the North Atlantic Council decided to activate our defense plans at request of our top military commander, General Todd Walters. This is a prudent and defensive step to protect and shield allied nations during this crisis. And it will enable us to deploy capabilities and forces, including the NATO Response Force, to where they are needed. In response to Russia's massive military buildup, we have already strengthened our collective defense on land, at sea, and in the air. In the last weeks, allies from North America and Europe have deployed thousands or more troops to the eastern part of the lines and placed more on standby. We have over 100 jets at high alert protecting our airspace and more than 120 allied ships at sea from the high north to the Mediterranean. All this shows that our collective defense commitment, Article 5, is ironclad. We will continue to do whatever is necessary to shield the alliance from aggression. I have called a virtual summit of NATO leaders tomorrow to address the way forward. Russia is now facing severe costs and consequences imposed by the whole international community. The Kremlin's aim is to re-establish its sphere of influence, rip up the global rules that have kept us all safe for decades, and subvert the values that we hold dear. This is the new normal for our security. Peace cannot be taken for granted. Freedom and democracy are contested by authoritarian regimes, and strategic competition is on the rise. We must respond with renewed resolve and even stronger unity. North America and Europe together in NATO. We are an alliance of 30 democracies standing as one. We will protect our people and our values. Democracy will always prevail over autocracy. Freedom will always prevail over oppression. And then I'm ready to take your questions.
We'll go to Interfax Ukraine.
Thank you, Anna. Interfax Ukraine, Irina Sommer. Secretary General, we all know that NATO will not fight for Ukraine. But don't you think it's time for NATO to build anti-Putin coalition? Thank you.
NATO stands in solidarity with Ukraine, and NATO allies are imposing severe costs on Russia for the reckless invasion of Ukraine. NATO allies, in close coordination with the European Union and other partners all the world, are now imposing severe economic sanctions on Russia to demonstrate that we follow up on what we said, and that is that it will be a high price for Russia to pay. NATO allies have also over a long period of time provided support, practical support, military support to Ukraine, and help them to build a much stronger, much better equipped, much better trained armed force today than the Ukraine had in 2014. And I would like to recognize the professionalism and the bravery of the Ukrainian men and women in uniform who are now standing up against the Russian invasion. So we continue to stand together, condemning the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and allies stand together also in sending a message that we will never accept the brutal violation of international law that we see taking place as Russia now invades Ukraine.
We'll go to Bloomberg.
Information that shows that NATO allies face a direct threat from Russia at the moment? And would NATO reconsider military intervention in Ukraine? Thank you.
So NATO is the strongest alliance in history. And make no mistake, we will defend and protect every ally against any attack and every inch of NATO territory. And that's the reason also we have increased our presence in the eastern part of the alliance with thousands of more troops, ships and planes over the last weeks. To send a very clear message that an attack on one ally will trigger the response of the whole alliance. And we do so not to provoke a conflict, but to prevent a conflict. What we do is defensive, it's prudent, it's measured, but it is necessary because we see the aggressive actions of Russia against Ukraine, and therefore allies also have to make sure that there is no room for any misunderstanding about that Russia can do anything like that against a NATO allied country.
National Public Radio.
Hi, thank you. Terry Schultz with NPR and DW. Mr. Secretary General, in the next statement, you say that we're deploying additional defensive land and air forces to the eastern part of the alliance, additional maritime assets, and increase the readiness of forces. Is this now, today, more forces being sent as a result of the fact that the invasion has now happened, or are you there referring to what has already been done as reinforcements? I understand SECOR will now have the ability to assemble the VJTF without coming back to the NAC for approval. And finally, are you still willing to sit down with President Putin or other representatives of the Russian government after this, or are you suspending your offer to hold talks on other issues and the NATO-Russia Council? Thank you.
This invasion doesn't come as a surprise. We are warned against this for months. And sadly, what happened this morning during the night was something that Allied security and intelligence services have predicted for a long time. We have tried to prevent it by calling on Russia to engage in diplomatic efforts, by telling Russia that there will be severe costs, economic sanctions, if they invade Ukraine further. But what has happened over the last hours demonstrates that Russia, despite our diplomatic efforts and despite our clear message of economic sanctions, decided to once again invade Ukraine. But since we have been warning against this for a long period of time, we have also taken prudent measures to prepare ourselves. And that's the reason why we, over the last months and weeks, have significantly increased the presence of NATO troops in the eastern part of the alliance. More land troops, ground forces, but also air and naval forces. In the coming days and weeks, there will come even more. So we will further increase, and we are increasing, our presence in the eastern part of the lines. And today we activated NATO's defense plans that gives our military commanders more authority to move forces. And to deploy forces when needed, and of course this could also be elements of the NATO response force. So we are ready, we are adjusting our posture, but what we do is defensive, is measured, and we don't see confrontation. We want to prevent the conflict and any attack against any NATO allied country. Well, we have reached out to Russia for weeks and months, and what we have seen is that the Russian message has been that they actually have never taken these talks seriously. Because while we were trying to find a political solution, they were planning for this invasion. And while we were trying to find a political solution, they were actually day by day, week by week, increasing their military presence and readiness on the borders of Ukraine, and now they launched the invasion. So Russia has shut the door to a political solution. We regret that, but that's sadly the reality, which has severe and very serious consequences for the people of Ukraine, but also actually impacts the security for all of us, and that's the reason why we step up our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Thanks a lot for taking the question. Secretary General, actually two questions. The first one, I'd like to hear your reaction to what President Putin said this morning when he announced the military operations. He said that any country that interferes with them would face consequences greater than you have seen in your history, which I take as a veiled threat with a nuclear attack. So please, what's your response to that? He did not specify what interference means. And the second question, very simple, Can the NATO-Russia Founding Act be upheld under these circumstances? Thank you.
The threatening rhetoric by President Putin and the aggressive actions by Russia, of course, is the reason why we are saying that we are now faced with a new normal for our security. And we need to consult closely all allies, and we also do that tomorrow when the leaders meet at the virtual summit. What does this mean for our longer-term relationship with Russia? How shall we continue to defend and protect allies in this new security reality? And how can we make sure that we uphold the values we believe in, freedom, democracy, faced with a more aggressive authoritarian regime in Moscow? A regime which is willing to openly contest our values and to threat and actually also use force to try to coerce other nations. So this will have some long-term effects on our security, on how we respond, on how NATO is reacting, and also on how our relationship with Russia can evolve. We don't have all the answers today, but there will be a new reality. It will be a new Europe after the invasion we saw today. And therefore I welcome the fact that we are so closely coordinating, so closely working together in NATO. We stood together in warning against the Russian aggression, the plans. We stood together in reaching out to Russia and tried to prevent the attack. And now we need to stand together in responding to the attack. And that's exactly what we are doing. That was the first question. The second question? Well, that's part of this new reality we have to look into. And there will be a different reality, and we need to respond, but this is not the day to draw the conclusions. But we will have an important discussion among leaders tomorrow.
And okay.
Thank you for the question. Mr. Secretary General, today Ukraine has called on Turkey to close the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles Straits for Russian vessels. Is that an action that was discussed in this morning's meeting, and are there other similar actions that have been discussed today?
That was not discussed in the meeting today. Turkey is, of course, a NATO ally. Turkey has a special role when it comes to the Bosporus Straits, but this was not an issue in the meeting this morning. What we discussed this morning was the need to activate the defense plans. We made a decision to activate those plans, which enables to move forces more quickly to where they are needed, and also to agree a statement where we express a very strong condemnation of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and also announced that we are going to have a NATO summit, a virtual NATO summit tomorrow.
Wall Street Journal.
Dan Michaels, Wall Street Journal, thank you for the question. Could you talk a little bit more about the activation of the defense plan? What exactly does this change, and when was the last time this was done? Thank you.
These plans are plans we have developed over the years to make sure that we have plans in place to react to crises like the crisis we are faced with now. And they are defensive plans, they are prudent plans, and they are plans that covers the whole east of our lines from the Barents Sea down to the Mediterranean. And they give our military commanders some more authorities within politically defined guidelines and frameworks to deploy forces where they deem it needed, and that's exactly what we have agreed today. So these, again, are defensive plans, ensuring that we have forces at the sufficient readiness at the right place throughout Europe.
Have they ever been activated before?
So I don't know whether it's right for me to answer that question, because I don't know whether it has been made public before, so I only said that we activated them today.
Associated Press.
Tucker Carlson, Associated Press. Is the NATO response force inside Ukraine right now?
No, there are no NATO combat troops, no troops, NATO troops at all inside Ukraine. We have made it clear that we don't have any plans and any intention of deploying NATO troops to Ukraine. What we have made clear is that we have already increased and we are increasing the presence of NATO troops in the eastern part of the alliance on NATO territory. Ukraine is a highly valued partner. We have supported Ukraine for many, many years. We helped them to build a more modern, capable armed force, military. We have helped them to train, equip, and in many different ways strengthen their armed forces. We helped them with cyber defenses, NATO and NATO allies in different ways. But we don't have NATO troops in Ukraine, and we don't have any plans to send NATO troops into Ukraine. But we are there to protect and defend all NATO allies. So we support Ukraine. We provide absolute security guarantees for NATO allies. And we demonstrate that commitment by increasing the presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
We'll try to take a couple of questions online before we come back to the press room. So we'll go to Steve Erlander from New York Times.
Thank you, Secretary General. Two quick questions. One, does NATO, do you still have military deconfliction contacts with Russian forces today? Are those ongoing? And secondly, a lot of NATO countries are going to want to keep supplying weapons to Ukraine. Do you foresee this as a major risk of NATO-Russia conflict? And where else do you see risks of conflict now between Russia and NATO countries that could spill over into something worse? Thank you, sir.
We have increased the presence in the eastern part of the alliance, and we have activated NATO defense plans today to make sure that we do not see any spillover to NATO territory. Because as long as Russia knows that an attack on a NATO ally will trigger a response from the whole alliance, they will not attack, because we are the strongest alliance in history. And as long as we stand together and make clear that we are committed by our collective defense commitments, that's the best way to prevent any attack, any spillover from the tragedy, the heinous attack we see in Ukraine, spill over onto any NATO allied country. The NATO allies have provided support to Ukraine in many different ways over the last years, especially since 2014. NATO has helped them with the cyber defenses. We have also helped them with some different trust funds for different activities, and then on top of that, and different capacity building measures, help them to strengthen including their naval forces and other elements of their armed forces. But then on top of what NATO has done as the alliance, NATO allies have also provided military equipment, including defensive weapons and other types of support training. It will be a national decision in what way allies continue to provide support. So that's for individual NATO allies to decide. Deconfliction is extremely important for us. There has been contacts between our military commanders and Russia. We will continue to reach out to them to make sure that we do everything we can to ensure deconfliction.
We'll next go to Helsinki and Sanomat, Teija Sutinen.
Yes, this is Teija Sutinen from the newspaper Helsinki and Sanomat. What is your message to the partnership countries, Finland and Sweden, in this situation? At least in Finland, there's a discussion about the possible NATO membership, but is this realistic during a crisis? Thank you.
Finland and Sweden are very close partners, and I have taken careful note of the very clear message, both from Finland and Sweden, that even though they don't apply for membership now, they strongly believe that NATO should not sign any kind of agreement with Russia based not Russia has proposed for us to sign a legally binding agreement ending any enlargement of NATO in the future. So I've seen that Sweden and Finland states that for them this is a question of self-determination, the sovereign right to choose their own path, and then potentially in the future also to apply for NATO membership. So for me, the very clear messages from Finland and Sweden just has underpinned how important it is that NATO allies do not compromise on core values, including the right for every nation to choose its own path, meaning whether it wants to belong to NATO or not belong to NATO. NATO respects those decisions regardless if it's yes or no to joining NATO. We very much value the close partnership with Finland and Sweden. It's important for NATO, it's important for Finland and Sweden. I visited Finland and Sweden this fall together with North Atlantic Council, and we see how closely we work together, exercise together, increase our ability to operate together, interoperability, and we also have very close political consultations. And therefore, I have invited Sweden and Finland to the virtual summit tomorrow, the NATO summit tomorrow. So at the NATO summit tomorrow, we'll have Sweden, Finland, and the two EU presidents present, showing in a way the very strong unity we demonstrate, transatlantic, NATO, and also close partners, EU, Finland, and Sweden.
We'll go to Polish radio. Marta Pomaska, Polish radio. If I may, follow-up question to Terry's question. When exactly these high readiness element of the national of the NATO response force may be deployed? Is it up to the leaders if you convene the summit for tomorrow? Thank you.
First of all, we have already deployed thousands of troops. And for instance, to Poland, there are more U.S. forces, there are more forces from the United Kingdom, and there are also all the nations deploying more forces to Poland and also to other countries in the eastern part of the alliance. More ships in the Baltic Sea and more planes conducting air policing and protecting our airspace. So this is going on, and there will be more forces in the east of the alliance over the next days and weeks. Then that could include elements of the NATO response force, but the most important thing is not exactly which elements of which forces, but the most important thing for Poland, for the other allies in the Eastern Partner Alliance, is that there are more NATO forces in the East. And there is and there will be even more NATO forces in the East in the coming days and weeks.
Final question to TV2.
Thank you for the question. This is Thurston from TV2 Norway. Secretary General, you have received apparently very good intelligence in recent weeks. You have shared it. You have been open about it. Do you have any information of the Russian plans ahead?
So our intelligence has been very precise because it has predicted over now several months the military build-up. But also the intentions, the plans of Russia to attack Ukraine. But of course, those plans could always be changed. And we continue to call on Russia to change its course and to not attack. And then we saw this morning that they attacked. And that was no surprise, because that was exactly what our intelligence services have predicted over several months. We have shared that intelligence to mainly try to prevent Russia from attacking. We have shared intelligence not only about the military build-up, but also about all the different attempts by Russia to create a pretext, stage situations that they can use as an excuse. These absolutely false claims of genocide against the Russians, or the alleged sabotage actions inside Russia and so on, it is false, it is staged, but we exposed those attempts because we hoped that that could reduce the risk of a military invasion. We have seen that they have stick to their plans. They have done as they actually planned for a long time ago. And we need to understand that throughout all these weeks and months, when they said that they have no plans of invading Ukraine, they had plans. And they were not only having plans, but they actually built up all these forces with one clear aim, and that was to invade Ukraine. And despite that, they were telling us, and the world and the public, that we have no plans to invade Ukraine. Yes, they had plans, and now we have seen that actually they were serious about invading Ukraine all the time. Never serious about really engaging in diplomatic efforts. What we see now is a full-fledged invasion of Ukraine from multiple directions. We see air, land, and naval forces taking part in those attacks. It's too early. We don't have a full damage assessment yet. But this is extremely serious. It's an attack on a peaceful, sovereign, independent nation. And it is a war of a type and a scale we actually thought was part of history in Europe, but now it's back in real, and it's imposing enormous suffering on innocent people in Ukraine.
Thank you very much. This concludes this press conference.
Thank you.
Now, that's the press conference. There was no yelling, no ranting and raving, no screaming. Blah, blah, blah. I'll call you. Everybody's quiet in the room. Answer your question. He gets the question answered. Gets a follow-up. He answers that question. They go on to the next person. There's no yelling. Blah, blah. There's no yelling, ranting, and raving. Because we have no couth in this country. That's the first thing. Because everybody believes that they have their right to do whatever they want. Well, I guess after so many years not having the right to do whatever you want, you now have the right and you run wild with it. We saw that when I was in the military and went over to Asia. Some of them kids on the farm from Wyoming, Montana, they ain't been off their damn property in 18 years. They got out to the big land with his parties every night, bars open till 5 a.m., never close. Say, half those kids went ballistic and drinking and jiving and got the everything you name under the sun, and they had no controls. This is how we are here. No controls. Now, speaking about no controls, we got Donald Trump. I wasn't thinking about him in the moment, Donald, because no controls. But he don't have no controls either, because he's just like it. Never been anywhere, except under the political bubble. But Secretary General Stoltenberg runs a great question-and-answer period, answers the questions firmly. He was just on just a few minutes ago, and now he's elected to send in the NATO. It's not the entire group, but I think it's 8,500 of the alert group he's sending in to the countries around Ukraine to show Trump and to show the clown over there, the misogynistic masochist, which he is, authoritarian. Misogynistic masochist, authoritarian. That is great. That's what he is. That's what Putin is. And you see, with those people, you cannot reason with. You cannot reason with them. They have one mind, one thing to do, and nothing else. So, will he or will he not go further? The man wants to go further. See, first of all, he thought that this was going to be a snap. 1, 2, 3. He get in and out of Ukraine in a couple of days. Hey, he's sitting on the border with 190,000 men couldn't enter the village in New York City. But he expected these people to just fold up their tents, say, okay, whatever you want. Because we were there before, and he didn't have that many. Well, that's why he don't have it anymore. And he's going to have to call a reinforcement. He can't handle, as I said before, 40 million people with less than 70,000 troops with guns and know how to use them. Fear is what he's banking on. Fear. They got us from the land. They got us from the sea. They got us from the air. It's all bullshit. Because he's not going to use it. What's the point of blowing up the cities that you're going to own that you have to take care of again? And you're not going to have any money to do that. Because we're taking him. They took some of his money today and took some of the ambassador. So we just have to see what's going to go on. But this was all planned by Trump and all the associates and all the other archivists. They thought that they would take over the world. And Trump had no idea how much a misogynistic friend he was running into. This man makes Trump like a pipsqueak. Because this man will kill you on the spot. Because he's a little man. All these little men, they always think that someone is trying to beat them up because they're little. Well, in fact, they're right. People take advantage of little people. And he has justified why he was going to be strong and know all the kung fu moves and all that other stuff. But you know what? Kung fu don't stop a bullet. Putin is in major trouble. Major, major trouble. And we're going to have to see what happens, how long it takes him to get to Kiev. Well, how long is it going to take him to get there? He's entering in now. How long before he controls the city? I don't think he will ever control the city. Not with the amount of men he's sending in there. He's got to send the rest of them in. He's sending the rest of them in there. Who's gone the rest of the hen house? So you see where he's at? He needs at least five times as many people. He has five times as many people as he has right now. He needs about 700,000 people there. Minimum. But if he does that, he got nowhere to guard in any place else. Okay. Nicole Wallace had a very important discussion on this, which I'd like you to hear also. Just listen.
It's 4 o'clock in New York on an historic day with war in Europe on a scale not seen since World War II. We're now 18 hours into a sweeping assault by Russian forces on the country of Ukraine. Ukraine's President Zelensky says his country is under attack, quote, from the south, the north, the east, and from the air. A senior U.S. defense official telling NBC News that Putin's goal is nothing short of capturing Kyiv and decapitating the Ukrainian government. Russian airstrikes so far have been focused on Ukraine's military and air defenses. That's according to the Pentagon. One of the most dangerous battles so far has unfolded in the area around the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Of course, the site of the worst nuclear accident in history. That plant is now reportedly in Russian hands. Ukrainian officials say at least 57 people have been killed. That number includes civilians, and that medical workers have come under fire. The invasion has resulted in scenes of desperation. On the ground in Ukraine, traffic is piling up on the roads leading out of Kyiv, and underground train stations in the city of Kharkiv, right on the border with Russia, are now doubling as bomb shelters, with men, women, and children crowding onto platforms and inside trains. For the United States and the West, the crisis is already a defining moment. President Joe Biden today ordered a new round of sanctions that target Russia's largest banks and members of the country's elites. and block Russia's ability to import technology. In remarks today, the president did not mince words, laying blame for the crisis entirely on Vladimir Putin. Listen.
We've been transparent with the world. We've shared declassified evidence about Russia's plans and cyber attacks and false pretexts so that there could be no confusion or cover-up about what Putin was doing. Putin is the aggressor. Putin chose this war, and now he and his country will bear the consequences. Putin's actions betray a sinister vision for the future of our world, one where nations take what they want by force. But it is a vision that the United States and freedom-loving nations everywhere will oppose with every tool of our considerable power.
We begin the hour with NBC News senior international correspondent Keir Simmons live for us in Moscow and NBC's Cal Perry live for us in Lviv, Ukraine. Cal, let me start with you. I believe that country's curfew has just gone into effect. Tell me what you've seen over the last couple hours. I've been watching you all day. Tell me the latest.
Well, for starters, the reason I'm coming to you live from inside this hotel room is the city of Lviv in the last hour said at 11 p.m. they wanted everybody to go to blackout conditions for security reasons. Blackout conditions are they don't want light showing to the street. So instead of turning off lights because we need them, we've shuttered the blinds. We've moved into the hotel room. I can tell you that most of the street lights have gone off. There are some still remaining, but all the more indication that the government here is just unclear about the scale of this and how this is going to go and how wide it's going to be. Lviv is supposed to be the fallback city, the safe place where people are able to retreat from the east as they move their way west towards Poland, towards those NATO troops, towards a border that they're able to cross. You mentioned those long lines, the issues that people are encountering, long lines for gas, trying to get out of Kyiv, trying to get money out of banks. There's been cyber attacks and a run on the banks. People are trying to get cash, they're trying to get petrol, and they're trying to get on the move. And the more that we sort of get down this road, and Richard Engel sort of described it well as we've sort of finished the first phase being the pinpoint attacks on military sites. The second phase, nobody knows. Is it going to be government sites? Are civilians going to be more in the line of fire? You have this human need to not leave your life behind, but the very real possibility that as we're now coming to you live from Lviv inside a hotel room with the windows closed, that the government is concerned that not only is this conflict going to widen, but that maybe Lviv is not as safe a place as they thought it would be.
This human need to not leave your life is what certainly, that's the perfect way to describe these images and to describe, I think, what was a careful balancing act on the part of President Zelensky, really almost disdainful, it seemed, for a long time about the United States talking and warning about war and Russian aggression. That has been abruptly change to deal with the reality. And I wonder, Cal, and I've wondered over the last 18 hours if people felt like they had enough time to prepare.
I don't think they did. And I think, you know, the government, as you've laid out, was trying to keep people calm. They were trying to keep people from fleeing. They were trying to keep a run on the banks. You had Washington saying that very serious things were happening. You had the Ukrainian government downplaying it. And then after we spoke yesterday, there was this unbelievable, surreal moment that I'm sure our viewers saw where you had the UN Security Council talking, you had Vladimir Putin giving a speech, and you had bombs dropping behind my colleagues in Kyiv and on the front lines. And you had here, in places like Lviv and around the country, this sudden realization by people here that not only was this real, but it arrived today, and that it is wider than just something happening in the east. And by the end of today, you had a fierce firefight at an airport just north of the capital, just 15 miles away from the capital, where Russian paratroopers have taken that airfield. We understand from the Ukrainian government that the Ukrainian government has taken that airfield back. But it just goes to show you that what Washington expected to happen and what Kyiv expected to happen were two completely different things, and it changed on a dime. It changed on a dime as the sun came up this morning, and I think that's why you're seeing this rush where people are making that impossible decision. Do they leave their lives behind in order to try to save the lives of their loved ones? I was speaking to somebody earlier today who was worried about their parents in Kyiv. They just don't want to leave, and that's the decision that people are trying to make here, and they're trying to make it on now an hourly basis, Nicole.
Horrific historical echoes in covering war in Europe. I wonder, Cal, if you can just talk to me about anything you are able to report about the numbers of casualties announced in the last hour by the Ukrainian government.
Yeah, so we've got our initial numbers, and just to stress, this is so early in this conflict. We're 15 hours in, at least 57 killed here in Ukraine, with almost 150 wounded, 149 exactly, according to the Ukrainian government. They are not yet able to differentiate between civilians and military personnel. They're just saying that this is how many people have died. But again, I'm going to be using that phrase at least, because we don't have a clear picture of what is happening on these front lines. People like Richard Engel and Matt Bradley and Aaron McLaughlin are kind of stuck where they are. I mean, it's impossible to move around this country right now, and so it's hard to get that wide look. We keep putting up this great map with all of these red dots everywhere, and it's very representative of how this country feels. It feels under attack from all of these different directions. For the first time since World War II, the air sirens went off here in Lviv this morning. It hasn't happened since World War II, and it was a shocking moment for people who live in this European city. It's completely surreal. I know I keep using that word, but it is such a surreal situation to be in Europe, to be the city that hosted the UEFA Cup in 2012 with Poland, is now under possible aerial bombardment, is something that I think, even though people are now living through in hour number 15 of this, they still can't quite believe it.
And tell me about Chernobyl. What are the concerns on the ground about Russia seizing control of Chernobyl, Cal?
It was really unclear to me what was going on, and in the early planning of this, the assumption was that the Russian troops would avoid the area. We had this red arrows, you know, going around Chernobyl. Well, they've secured the area, we understand, and there is an infrastructure reason for doing so. There is still a power plant there. We thought initially the request to go to blackout conditions was to save energy, and we were corrected by both the government and our hotel. It said, no, this is a blackout for security reasons. So you have this concern about the basic infrastructure here. Certainly the Russians are starting to take out that infrastructure. I mean, the goal here is to make this an ungovernable place. If you're trying to, as we know Vladimir Putin is, if you're trying for some kind of change in the government, you know, he's hitting all the right targets, because you want to make this impossible to govern. So power, water, the sewage, all of the basic things that people rely on, the gas lines. I mean, if you can unravel the society, you know, that's as destabilizing as an occupation, even possibly more destabilizing. If the end goal here is government replacement, certainly it would explain some of the targets. Very quickly, you know, one of the things we do need to mention, the Ukrainian president is keeping his location undisclosed for all the obvious reasons. There was discussions about maybe him coming here to Lviv. The American administration made it clear they really want him to remain in the country, but he's taken himself off the location grid. We don't know where he is, and that, again, as I come to you from a hotel room with the blinds closed, is for fairly obvious reasons.
Obvious reasons, but not without its own destabilizing effects. Keir Simmons, you know, what I want to say, what I'm going to say, as usual, has some distance between them, but tell me how starting a war in Europe has been received in Moscow.
Well, Nicole, people are stunned, shocked, here in Moscow, and I think across Russia, and I think that's because, keep in mind, and we just have to say it again and again, that there are millions of Ukrainians living here in Russia, there are many, many Russians living in Ukraine. These are two countries that are interconnected. I don't think that people here really believed it was going to happen. They certainly hoped it wouldn't happen. I actually spoke to one woman and her daughter, 11-year-old daughter, the daughter's grandfather, the woman's father, is in Ukraine. They haven't been able to talk, they haven't been able to be with each other for 3 years because of COVID, and now they are torn apart, their family torn apart by the war, and that story is being repeated again and again and again. And it goes to the question of whether or not President Putin is going to be able to take his country with him. Earlier today we went out just to ask people how they felt about it. Take a listen.
I've been crying from the morning, so I know what to do. My men, the men they love, is a Ukrainian citizen. So for me, it's quite a tragedy.
It's horrible, yeah. It's horrible. It should be done by diplomatic way.
Nicole, there have been some protests here in Moscow. People arrested, but small, as you can imagine. You know how President Putin has crushed opposition. And I will say this, because things unfold in unexpected ways when it comes to a conflict. If the Russian people turn against what President Putin has done, that will be threatening to President Putin. He may feel cornered. The implications of it, well, we wait to see what happens.
Well, Kara, a super follow-up for you. You're going to have to say more. And two, I mean, expand on this point. And isn't
presented to me is not implausible, that someone fighting on behalf of Russia could end up, you know, face-to-face fighting against an immediate family member fighting on behalf of Ukraine. That this is not like distant relatives. Nuclear families live across those two borders. Can you add some meat on those bones?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's completely possible. And, you know, at the same time, we've heard President Putin talk about the two countries as one. Of course they're not one, because Ukraine is a democracy. That's the point. Doesn't matter what the family ties or the friendship ties are, Ukraine is a democracy. That's a crucial question. Listen, you know, I think there's something important here to talk about too, though, Nicole, and you and I have had so many conversations over the years about who is this person, Vladimir Putin. Well, that conversation has never been more important, has it, as right now, because we know inside the Kremlin, he is the person, he is the one guy who is making the decisions. We heard President Biden talk about sanctions today. Just a few hours before that, President Putin was talking to business leaders and told them, don't worry, Russia's not going to be ejected from the world economy. Now, there's going to be conversation going forward about the nature of the sanctions and whether they were strong enough. But here, there's going to be conversations, and there are conversations about whether President Putin, let me put it like this, whether President Putin is deluded or whether he's being deluded. What I mean by that is, for example, his television address this morning announcing that there would be war in Ukraine and railing against NATO and the US, at times you watch and you wonder, where is he getting his information from? Does he really believe this? Because he seems so earnest. And I think one of the answers to this might be that he has a very small circle around him, and he doesn't use computers, he doesn't use phones, he doesn't use emails that aren't secure. So the information that he gets is limited. So many people talk about this in relation to President Putin. One more thing just to say about all of that, Nicole. Earlier in the week, we saw President Putin dress down the chief of his Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, Sergei Naryshkin, interrupted him at the Security Council, made him sit down. A terrifying display, honestly. And it tells you something, because Sergei Naryshkin known Vladimir Putin for 40 years. They were both in the KGB together, and that's how he treats him. So ask yourself this. Are the people around President Putin giving him the information that he needs, or are they giving him the information that he wants? Are they telling him, for example, that Kyiv will fall, that the government will fall, that a pro-Russian government will take over there? Because that doesn't seem like it's very likely. What is President Putin being told about what's happening in the conflict? What is he being told about the potential for economic sanctions? All of these issues, because, again, remember that it is President Putin who is leading this. He is making decisions, nobody else. So it's an absolutely crucial question.
And it's a portrait of a leader that I think we've all covered and talked about as well, cloistered and cherry-picking his own intelligence and information. And I guess I want to just close the circle here by asking you if the outcry among the public is likely to even make it to Putin. I mean, I know he's thin-skinned and sensitive and vain, and hence all the shirtless photo ops, but will he hear how disgusted his own population is by the fact that their leader started a war in Europe?
It's a great question. We should remember that there are lots of Russians who do support him, who believe the things that are being said on television, the television networks here playing over and over allegations, propaganda, suggesting that Ukraine is attacking Russians in eastern Ukraine, so there is that aspect of it. We should remember that. But it's a great question, because it is, of course, the people that President Putin is most frightened of. It's actually part of the reason why this is happening, because he doesn't want, there were revolutions in Ukraine that brought in new leaders, new governments. Mm-hmm. President Putin is determined not to let the Russian people believe that you can overturn a government and then live in freedom and democracy. That would be incredibly threatening to him, and that is part of the explanation for why we are where we are now.
You know, I am always honored to talk to both of you, but NBC's Keir Simmons, NBC's Cal Perry, thank you to both of you. We'll be here for a while, so wave your arms if you've got any updates for us. Thank you so much. Stay safe.
Well, I'm sorry. So, that's the story. Leading up to... they estimate about 4 million people are going to be running from Ukraine. 4 million people to Poland, which is the closest spot. They know the NATO forces are there. We sent extra NATO forces there to prepare for the people coming over. But we don't know how long these the Ukrainian soldiers are going to hold out. The Russians got into the mood where they're dressed up like putting on Ukrainian uniforms so they get close to the people. But the people are going to know. They're going to know beforehand. And they're going to realize what these clowns have done. The people are going to realize, you know, they could be fighting your cousin or your uncle on the other side. You could be. And they're not advancing to the point where they can bring in more soldiers yet. The Russians don't seem to be ready for some reason. And today they were put on major sanctions. Putin, Medved, all the top leaders. So let's see how much money. There's still more stuff they can do. So let's just see what the president said.
Good afternoon. The Russian military has begun a brutal assault on the people of Ukraine. Without provocation, without justification, without necessity, this is a premeditated attack. Vladimir Putin has been planning this for months, as we've been saying all along. He moved more than 175,000 troops, military equipment, and positions along the Ukrainian border. He moved blood supplies into position and built a field hospital, which tells you all you need to know about his intentions all along. He rejected every good faith effort the United States and our allies and partners made to address our mutual security concerns through dialogue, to avoid needless conflict and avert human suffering. For weeks, we have been warning that this would happen. And now, it's unfolding largely as we predicted. In the past week, we've seen shelling increase in the Donbas, a region in eastern Ukraine controlled by Russian-backed separatists. The Russian government has perpetrated cyber attacks against Ukraine. We saw a staged political theater in Moscow, outlandish and baseless claims that Ukraine was about to invade and launch a war against Russia, that Ukraine was prepared to use chemical weapons. Ukraine committed a genocide without any evidence. We saw a flagrant violation of international law in attempting to unilaterally create two new so-called republics on sovereign Ukrainian territory. And at the very moment that the United Nations Security Council was meeting to stand up for Ukraine's sovereignty, to stave off invasion, Putin declared his war. Within moments, missile strikes began to fall on historic cities across Ukraine. Then came the air raids, followed by tanks and troops rolling in. We've been transparent with the world. We've shared declassified evidence about Russia's plans and cyber attacks and false pretexts so that there could be no confusion or cover-up about what Putin was doing. Putin is the aggressor. Putin chose this war, and now he and his country will bear the consequences. Today, I'm authorizing additional strong sanctions and new limitations on what can be exported to Russia. This is going to impose severe costs on the Russian economy, both immediately and over time. We have purposely designed these sanctions to maximize the long-term impact on Russia and to minimize the impact on the United States and our allies. I want to be clear, the United States is not doing this alone. For months, we've been building a coalition of partners representing well more than half the global economy. 27 members of the European Union, including France, Germany, Italy, as well as the United Kingdom, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and many others, to amplify the joint impact of our response. I just spoke with the G7 leaders this morning, and we're in full and total agreement. We will limit Russia's ability to do business in dollars, euros, pounds, and yen to be part of the global economy. We'll limit their ability to do that. We're going to stunt the ability to finance and grow the Russian military. We're going to impose major, and we're going to impair their ability to compete in high-tech 21st century economy. We've already seen the impact of our actions on Russia's currency and the ruble, which early today hit its weakest level ever in history. The Russian stock market plunged today. The Russian government borrowing rates spiked by over 15%. In today's actions, we've now sanctioned Russian banks that together hold around $1 trillion in assets. We've cut off Russia's largest bank, a bank that holds more than one-third of Russia's banking assets by itself, cut it off from the U.S. financial system. And today, we're also blocking four more major banks. That means every asset they have in America will be frozen. This includes VTB, the second largest bank in Russia, which has $250 billion in assets. As promised, we're also adding the names to the list of Russian elites and their family members that we're sanctioning as well. As I said on Tuesday, these are people who personally gained from the Kremlin's policies, and they should share in the pain. We will keep up this drumbeat of those designations against corrupt billionaires in the days ahead. On Tuesday, we stopped the Russian government from raising money from U.S. or European investors. Now we're going to apply the same restrictions to Russia's largest state-owned enterprises, companies with assets that exceed $1.4 trillion. Some of the most powerful impacts our actions will come over time. As we squeeze Russia's access to finances and technology for strategic sectors of its economy and degrade its industrial capacity for years to come. Between our actions and those of our allies and partners, we estimate that we'll cut off more than half of Russia's high-tech imports. It'll strike a blow to their ability to continue to modernize their military. It'll degrade their aerospace industry, including their space program. It'll hurt their ability to build ships, reducing their ability to compete economically. And it will be a major hit to Putin's long-term strategic ambitions. And we're preparing to do more. In addition to the economic penalties we're imposing, we're also taking steps to defend our NATO allies, particularly in the East. Tomorrow, NATO will convene a summit. We'll be there to bring together the leaders of 30 allied nations and close partners to affirm our solidarity and to map out the next steps we will take to further strengthen all aspects of our NATO alliance. Although we provided over $650 million in defensive assistance to Ukraine just this year, last year, let me say it again, our forces are not and will not be engaged in the conflict with Russia in Ukraine. Our forces are not going to Europe to fight in Ukraine, but to defend our NATO allies and reassure those allies in the East. As I made crystal clear, the United States will defend every inch of NATO territory with the full force of American power. And the good news is, NATO is more united and more determined than ever. There is no doubt that the United States and every NATO ally will meet our Article 5 commitments, which says an attack on one is an attack on all. Over the past few weeks, I ordered thousands of additional forces to Germany and Poland as part of our commitment to NATO. On Tuesday, in response to Russia's aggressive action, including its troop presence in Belarus and the Black Sea, I've authorized deployment of ground and air forces already stationed in Europe to NATO's eastern flank allies, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Romania. Our allies have also been stepping up, adding the other allies, the rest of NATO, adding their own forces and capabilities to ensure collective defense. And today, within hours of Russia's unleashing its assault, NATO came together and authorized and activated an activation of response plans. This will enable NATO's high readiness forces to deploy and when and where they are needed to protect our NATO allies on the eastern boundaries of Europe. And now I'm authorizing additional U.S. force capabilities to deploy to Germany as part of NATO's response, including some of the U.S.-based forces that the Department of Defense placed on standby weeks ago. I've also spoken with Defense Secretary Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, about preparations for additional moves should they become necessary to protect our NATO allies and support the greatest military alliance in the history of the world, NATO. As we respond, my administration is using the tools, every tool at its disposal, to protect American families and businesses from rising prices at the gas pump. You know, we're taking active steps to bring down the cost, and American oil and gas companies should not exploit this moment to hike their prices to raise profits. You know, in our sanctions package, we specifically designed to allow energy payments to continue. We are closely monitoring energy supplies for any disruption. We've been coordinating with major oil producing and consuming countries toward our common interest to secure global energy supplies. We are actively working with countries around the world to elevate collective release from the strategic petroleum reserves of major energy consuming countries. And the United States will release additional barrels of oil as conditions warrant. I know this is hard and that Americans are already hurting. I will do everything in my power to limit the pain the American people are feeling at the gas pump. This is critical to me. But this aggression cannot go unanswered. If it did, the consequences for America would be much worse. America stands up to bullies. We stand up for freedom. This is who we are. Let me also repeat the warning I made last week. If Russia pursues cyber attacks against our companies, our critical infrastructure, we are prepared to respond. For months, we've been working closely with the private sector to harden their cyber defenses, sharpen our ability to respond to Russian cyber attacks as well. I spoke last night to President Zelensky of Ukraine, and I assured him that the United States, together with our allies and partners in Europe, will support the Ukrainian people as they defend their country. We'll provide you humanitarian relief to ease their suffering. In the early days of this conflict, Russia propaganda outlets will keep trying to hide the truth and claim success for its military operation against a made-up threat. But history has shown, time and again, how swift gains in territory eventually give way to grinding occupations, acts of mass civil disobedience, and strategic dead ends. The next few weeks and months, we hard on the people of Ukraine. Putin has unleashed a great pain on them. But the Ukrainian people have known 30 years of independence. They have repeatedly shown that they will not tolerate anyone who tries to take their country backwards. This is a dangerous moment for all of Europe, for the freedom around the world. Putin has committed an assault on the very principles that uphold the global peace. Now, the entire world sees clearly what Putin and his Kremlin allies are really all about. This was never about a genuine security concerns on their part. It was always about naked aggression, about Putin's desire for empire by any means necessary, by bullying Russia's neighbors through coercion and corruption, by changing borders by force, and ultimately by choosing a war without a cause. Putin's actions betray a sinister vision for the future of our world, one where nations take what they want by force. But it is a vision that the United States and freedom-loving nations everywhere will oppose with every tool of our considerable power. The United States and our allies and partners will emerge from this stronger, more united, more determined, and more purposeful. And Putin's aggression against Ukraine will end up costing Russia dearly, economically and strategically. We will make sure of that. Putin will be a pariah on the international stage. Any nation that countenances Russia's naked aggression against Ukraine will be stained by association. When the history of this era is written, Putin's choice to make a totally unjustifiable war on Ukraine will have left Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. Liberty, democracy, human dignity, these are the forces far more powerful than fear and oppression. They cannot be extinguished by tyrants like Putin and his armies. They cannot be erased by people, from people's hearts and hopes by any amount of violence and intimidation. They endure. In the contest between democracy and autocracy, between sovereignty and subjugation, make no mistake, freedom will prevail. God bless the people of a free and democratic Ukraine, and may God protect our troops.
That was the president. Let me plug myself in here. That was the president. And what we need to, I guess I am on, I can't hear myself, but what we are going to do is to, I need to play one more thing before we get off here today, but this is real now. We're very, very close to having an incident with the Russians. Very close. And the next, I'd say 72 hours, we'll know. Right now, I want you to hear one thing. With I love this guy, Colonel Wilkerson. He was on with Ari Melba. He gave us a real inkling into what Putin might be thinking.
Russia has invaded Ukraine, starting a war. Here is some of the reaction in Washington today.
This will be a long and bloody campaign, a pointless, needless, disastrous campaign. That may take months and it may take years. And all along the way, we need to have Ukraine's back.
That was, of course, a top Democrat, Adam Schiff. But we also want to show you what we're seeing. Several major Republican leaders condemning in a similar fashion Putin's horrific invasion, vowing to work with the president and hold Putin accountable. Here was Senate Minority Republican Leader McConnell.
I have some advice. Ratchet the sanctions all the way up. Don't hold any back. Vladimir Putin is a bad guy. He's an authoritarian. He yearns for empire. And we need to do everything we can to stop him.
What you see here is something that is not as common, especially nowadays in Washington, even on matters of foreign policy. But while there has been some right-wing support on the fringes for a kind of a denialism or defensiveness around Putin, in the main, top Republicans are basically condemning this as a war of aggression by Putin and more or less coming into lockstep with the Biden response, which is tough sanctions, or as you heard from McConnell, even tougher, and no boots on the ground, which is to say the major policy planks right now are not becoming yet a matter of partisan debate. That's the president and the congressional leaders. They have the power. When it comes to someone who has no power, no say, but does have a tortured history with Vladimir Putin and, of course, a media following in Republican politics, well, this is what he had to say.
This is something that should have never happened. This would not have happened during my administration. And it's a very sad thing for the world, for the country. And it's certainly very sad for a lot of people that are going to be needlessly killed.
We turn now to two experts with high-level government experience here, former Assistant Secretary of State P.J. Crowley, former Chief of Staff to Colin Powell, Colonel Larry Wilkerson. Welcome to both of you. Colonel Wilkerson, your thoughts on what we are hearing from a somewhat united front from leaders in Washington.
You know, I think it was Voltaire who said that hypocrisy is the tribute vice pays to virtue pays to vice. I got to say that I have heard so much hypocrisy over the last couple of months, couple of years, that it's appalling. The fact that it's unified in the Congress makes it almost laughable. That said, this situation in military terms is really, as Clausewitz in his War warned, a transient event, and we should beware of focusing on it. I don't mean that there aren't some horrible things happening, but Ukraine is not a threat. It is not a fundamental threat to the United States. America was in the Soviet Union for 40-some-odd years. Yes, it was there with East Germany. It was there with Poland. It was not a threat then, really. It had nuclear weapons, but they were controlled. controlled in Moscow. So it, fundamentally, it's not a threat. This is a transient event, as tragic as it may be for Ukrainians.
Well, let's break down. Let me break down. I'll do the moderator thing, and then you'll get to talk again. So I get it. Right. But what you're saying is in contrast to what a lot of people are hearing all day about a geostrategic showdown and these concerns. So I was just going to ask you to explain a little more what you mean by transient and what you mean by not of import in the U.S. security interest, if that's what you're getting at.
What I'm getting at is that Putin will probably go and consolidate his control over the two westernmost oblasts, much the way he did in Georgia. He might even try to carve out a corridor down to Odessa. Odessa, after all, is a more important point to Russia than any port in Crimea. So if he does that and stops, then we can get back to more important things like nuclear weapons arms control and the climate crisis. If he doesn't stop, if he goes on and tries to swallow Ukraine, as one of your interlocutors just said, he's in trouble. He's in big trouble. Because Ukrainians will fight, he'll be in a guerrilla war. He'll be like we were in Iraq, he'll be defeated. But Putin doesn't have the stores to fall back on, economic or financial. He'll bring down the Russian economy, and he'll bring himself down. So while it seems strange to recommend patience and waiting, we're in the stronger position. Let's don't commit to something that's stupid.
PJ?
Well, I'll agree with Larry up to the point that Russia is a declining power. That said, Vladimir Putin came into power in 2000 when I was on the National Security Council staff under President Clinton, and he's been a profound irritant now, to multiple presidents. So I'm not sure. We have to broaden the lens a little bit. Ukraine is important to the extent that. Of the concept of international affairs, that sovereign nations get to determine, their own future, and that can't be imposed, from beyond. And certainly one person who's watching these events unfold very closely is Xi Jinping, because if we do fumble the response to Ukraine, then, what happens later on when it comes to the future of Taiwan? So but by the same token, what is important for us, is the unity of the NATO alliance. So we may have a limited ability to shape events now in Ukraine in the short to midterm, but we certainly, have a very profound interest in making sure that the alliance stays together and that Putin pays the price.
Well, this is the idea that we hear so much. That is of a concern of whether this is something where great powers get to use that power and then nobody stops them and it upends the entire so-called global order. The counter response to that is that it's not that orderly to begin with. The president you serve, PJ, making your point today, Obama saying we've seen forces of authoritarianism, quote, make headway around the world, an assault on democracy, the rule of law, equality, Russia's invasion of Ukraine shows where these dangerous trends can lead and why they cannot be left unchallenged. Colonel Wilkerson, we always appreciate more than one view and style, and I think you are, if I may say so respectfully, somewhat outside the mainstream of where a lot of your foreign policy colleagues have sounded like over the past couple of days. So I give you the rebuttal to that, the idea that unchecked this is bad for our long-term interests.
You're absolutely right. I'm outside this warmongering that even the New York Times and others are doing. I'm not for war. I'm not for any kind of war that is useless and stupid. And that's what it would be if we got involved in the Ukraine conflict directly. Now, sanctions and supplying weapons and so forth, that's okay. I believe maximum sanctions would do what I said would be done to Putin if he got involved in the entire length and breadth of Ukraine. But the hypocrisy still appalls me. The New York Times the other day accused Putin of doing all manner of things, crossing international borders, violating national sovereignty. So that's exactly what the United States has been doing for the past 20 years. That's what we did in 2003 in spades in Iraq. It's what we're doing right now today in Syria, where we have no authority under international law to be. It's what we've been doing. So this hypocrisy appalls me. At the same time, I admit we have a situation today that we need to do something about, but what we need to do about it is have patience. strategic patience. If Putin bites off more than he can chew, he's finished. If he stops where he is, we can live with that, and we can get back to the issues that really matter, like nuclear weapons.
Colonel Wilkerson and P.J. Crowley, multiple perspectives here, and we're the more informed for it. Appreciate both of you.
And everybody have a great weekend.